Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. On today's show, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Michelle Alexander. Actually, it's going to be a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Michelle Alexander when her book, The New Jim Crow, first came out. And the reason for doing this interview again is because I think people can never hear too many times what the hell is going on in relation to black people and the way they're treated under this system. The police terror, the mass incarceration, the actual slow genocide that's being unleashed on black people by this system. And in relation to that, I'm opening the show up with an interview I did recently with Carl Dix, and this is about the October 22nd National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's a co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition, as well as the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Now, I wanted to have you on to talk about a very important day that's coming up and a very important series of actions occurring across the country, and that is October 22nd, the 17th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. Can you explain to people what that day is all about?
Well, what that day is that it is the day when resistance to the official abuse that law enforcement brings down on people, police brutality, police murder, immigration raids, treating whole generations of young people like criminals, guilty until proven innocent if they can survive to prove their innocence. It's the day for people to stand up all across the country and resist that. And it's also the day when those whose lives have been devastated by police murder, the families and survivors of police murder victims, are given a platform to tell the truth about what happened to their family members, to counter the lies and slander that the police toss out about the people that they kill. And it's a day when people from all different backgrounds, different races and nationalities come together to stand against this abuse. This is going to be the 17th year that we mark this day. It's going to be happening in cities all across the country. What's going on in different cities is being put together right now. And people can go to the website www.october22.org, and then you can do /assembly.html to find out what's happening in cities across the country. And if people want to add an activity that they're doing, they can go to that website, find the email address, and send in the information.
Before we jump into all of that, let's step back for a minute. You keep referring to, I read an article you wrote in a recent issue of Revolution newspaper, and I wanted to ask you this. You talk about this being an emergency situation today, and we can talk about what that portends, what the implications that has for October 22nd this year, but what are you talking about? What is the situation today, and why do you characterize it as an emergency situation?
I characterize it as an emergency situation because essentially what we're dealing with is a slow genocide aimed particularly at black people and Latino people. And I know when people hear that, they're going to be like, oh, man, he's trying to hype the situation up. It ain't a genocide. It might be bad, but it ain't that bad. Well, it actually is a genocide because, look, the international definition of genocide, and I looked this up, because most people think of genocide as Nazi Germany and what happened to the Jews and people being killed in horrific numbers. And that is one aspect of genocide, but that's the end of the process. There's a process that leads up to it, and the actual international definition is genocide is when conscious activity is taken up by authorities that hamper the ability of a people to survive and thrive. Now, let's actually look at what's going on in this country. We could talk about the police brutality and police murder, and there are too many instances of people killed by the police. We could talk about Anaheim and the two young men who were killed there. We could talk about the young man in the back of the police car, double handcuffed, who gets shot in the head, and then the police say he did it to himself, even though they had searched him twice and he had no gun. We could talk about the homeless guy in Saginaw, Michigan, 46 police bullets fired at him. We could talk about the woman in downtown L.A., what they call Skid Row, who was beaten to death by the police. We could talk about Ramarley Graham, where the police in the Bronx, New York, followed him to his house, kicked down the door, and shot him dead in front of his grandmother and his six-year-old brother. talk about all that and many, many more cases, but I don't have time to get into all of them. This is very widespread, and the police who carry out this brutality and this murder are almost never punished. We could talk about the racial profiling. Here in New York, they give it an official name, stop and frisk. In most cities, they don't call it anything official. They just carry it out where they target especially black and Latino youth and treat them like they're a guilty generation, a criminal generation, guilty until proven innocent. That's the pipeline to 2.4 million people in prison. Then on top of that, you've got millions of people, more than 5 million people, who have served their sentences but are still under the control of the probation and parole system, people who have lost rights. You get discriminated against when you go for a job. You can't live in public housing. You can't get a government loan, so you can't go back to school or try to start a business. You can't even live in public housing or can't even vote. That's millions more people. Then you add in the families and loved ones of all of those people. You've got tens of millions of people whose lives are enmeshed in the criminal injustice system of this country. Tens of millions of people, overwhelmingly black or Latino. That's large numbers of oppressed people who are not able to thrive. And that undercuts the ability of those whole people. So we're talking about what is really a critical situation. And you have a presidential election going on where you're supposed to be determining the direction of the country. This is something that has not come up for even mention by any of the major candidates. In other words, whoever goes to the White House, this is going to keep going on. And we saw when the first black president went into the White House, there was no easing up of this developing situation. So I call this a slow genocide, which could easily become a fast one. And it's one that really is built into how this system functions.
All right, Carl, I have a question for you. But first, I want to let people know that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. And I'm talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and from the October 22nd Coalition and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about the upcoming 17th National Day of Protest against Police Brutality, October 22nd, against police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And it's on October 22nd, as the coalition name would imply. Carl, you are talking about all of these things that are happening in society. And in your article, you say that all of this is built into the very fabric of this system. Let's talk about that and what that implies in terms of how people can actually resolve any of this.
Yeah, I mean, because, look, you go back to Richard Nixon's time as president, there were less than 300,000 people. This is back in the early 1970s. Less than 300,000 people in prison. Today, there are eight times that number. Also, you go back to that time, and it's the 1960s were ebbing, the period when radical and revolutionary uprisings from among the people spearheaded by the Black Liberation Movement was beginning to die down. But they were looking at this, the authorities, the people who run this country, and trying to figure out how to go forward. And Richard Nixon, at a cabinet meeting, is reported by several people in his cabinet to have said, "The problem is the blacks, and we have to devise a solution that doesn't acknowledge that that's what we're dealing with." And they came up with these wars on drugs and wars on crime, which were waged at that point almost exclusively in black neighborhoods. They expanded that to Latino neighborhoods as the demographics of the country changed. And what they were basically doing was unleashing law enforcement on people that they knew they were enforcing miserable conditions and inequality on, and they remembered how people responded to that in the 1960s and were trying to get ahead of that. And this was coming from the fact that they had no future to offer people, that the globalization was taking the jobs out of the inner cities, the education system was being defunded, and they knew that people would hate the conditions that were being enforced. So their approach was to clamp down on people, to criminalize them, to trap them up in prison, and that would be how they would keep them from rising up, in effect waging a counterinsurgency before the insurgency could break out. So the way that you have to come at this, you shouldn't expect that we're going to get any change through the elections, because whoever presides over this system, whether you end up this time with Obama or Romney. This is going to keep on going. It's going to take a revolution, getting rid of this system and building a totally different and far better society in its place to resolve this. Now, it's not time to rise up in revolution. Things ain't gotten to the point they need to get to for that. But people can't sit back and wait for that. What's necessary right now is resistance. And October 22nd is a very critical day to mount that resistance. It's a day to actually take all of this stuff on, and we need to bring people out to stand up on that day and say that this police brutality, this police murder, treating our young people like criminals, separating families through immigration raids, racial profiling, whether it's aimed at black people, at Latinos, or Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians is unacceptable. And bringing that resistance together is important. And the other reason that this kind of resistance is important is that it's when people stand up and resist injustice that they can raise their heads and begin to see what the real problems they're up against are and what the solution is. And we call our approach to this something that we call fight the power and transform the people for revolution. It's how people go from accepting the injustices as what has to, that's just the way things are, to seeing that these problems stem from a system and how it works, and that the solution is really to get rid of that system.
Now, Carl, and we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the October 22nd Coalition. And I should also mention that as part of, as one of the co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, you also co-founded the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement that's been taking place in New York or centered in New York City. Now, Carl, one of the things around that, you talk about in your article that October 22nd of this year, when you talk about needing to fight the power, you talk about resistance needed, you say that October 22nd this year has to be more than a day of protest as usual. And then you start to talk about the whistles, the blow the whistle kind of phenomenon that happened on September 13th.
September 13th,
yes. As part of Stop, Stop, and Frisk. Can you talk about what you mean when you say October 22nd, 2012 has to be more than a day of protest as usual?
Well, there has been, over the past year, very significant outbreaks of resistance. There were the prisoner hunger strikes, which are very important. And very soon, or maybe this has already happened, there's going to be a call coming out of the prisons for people of different races and nationalities who had been at each other's throats in the prison. They're calling for a peace among the different groupings in prison because the prisoners aren't each other's problems. It's the torturous conditions that's being brought down on them. And this is going to have big impact out on the streets. And we need to spread that call for unity. We need to bring out resistance to every way that the criminal injustice system comes down on people and bring that together. And where it ties in with the blow-the-whistle effort on September 13th that happened in different parts of the country is that was an effort that put resistance in the hands of the people themselves. Because last year we did a very important thing with the civil disobedience campaigns and dozens of people got arrested here in New York, targeting the stop-and-frisk racial profiling problem. But we knew when we did that we were limiting who would get involved because the people that the cops come down on don't really feel like they want to go out and get arrested in a campaign against being arrested by the police. However, with the whistles, this is a way that people can take up resistance in the neighborhoods that the police come down on. There's no law against blowing the whistle, even though cops might come after you around it. It's a way to alert others in the community that something's going down, that they need to pay attention, that they need to come out of the house and look at what these cops are doing. And these gatherings of people on the scene of cops brutalizing, abusing people is a way that people begin to understand we're not in this alone. We got to have each other's backs. We got to stand together. And they begin to look at themselves and each other differently, which is part of the change that has to happen. You know, when you go by and you see the cops with somebody, all too often people think, what did that person do? When often they ain't done nothing. They just been set upon by the cops because the cops didn't like the way they looked, maybe didn't like the color of their skin, maybe didn't like something they said. So we need people to begin to look at this like, what are those cops doing? Is that the actual wrongdoing that's going down here? Because all too often that is what the case is. And we need to take a leap in doing that on October 22nd. So we've issued a, I've issued a call for people around the country to go to the areas where blowing the whistle against law enforcement abuse had the most impact and take October 22nd to it and bring those people out on the 22nd and have them bring their whistles and their messages and their signs and banners with them and to stand together with people who are fighting this injustice, you know, all around the country.
Now, Carl, thinking about all this, and in particular thinking about the idea that it has to be a day of protest that's not your usual day of protest, one of the things that has always marked October 22nd from the very beginning has been the participation of family members, of people whose loved ones have been killed or brutalized by the police. You know, and it's always, whether it's in the series of PSAs that were done, the video PSAs that were done and aired all over the country, some of them on the MTV at that back in the day, back in the early days of October 22nd Coalition. But others, you know, it's continued where people speak out at rallies, where they speak out as much as they can, and they tell these very heartbreaking but also enraging stories. Now, as I've read in your piece, it's that's going to continue to be part of October 22nd this year, an important part of it. But you've also added something else, which has to do with what you've just been talking about in a lot of ways, this whole mass incarceration and this whole idea that an entire generation of people, the slow genocide of an entire people. What's the importance of bringing the prisons in on the same level, of bringing the question of prisons and prisoners in on the same level as the families?
Well, because it's all part of a process through which the authorities have consciously tried to clamp down on people that they hate and fear. And we have to get people out of viewing, well, if you went to prison, ooh, that's something scary, that's something negative, you should keep quiet about that, you should be ashamed of it. People need to actually speak about it and speak about what was done to them, because often it is a question of victimization. In some cases, just straight-up frame-ups, because, you know, in talking with people about the whole thing about stop and frisk, people often end up in jail because they don't have an ID on them. Or because they said to the cop, why are you stopping me? I didn't do anything wrong. That can get you not only arrested, but beat down, and then a charge of resisting arrest, because that's the charge they always give you when the cops beat you down for nothing. We need people to see that as part of the injustice that we're dealing with. And a way to do that is to take this thing of the tradition of the parents of police murder victims and other family members of police murder victims having a platform to speak, but also calling on those whose loved ones have been imprisoned or who themselves have been imprisoned to also have that platform to speak about how the criminal injustice system in this country has devastated their lives.
All right, Carl, we have to wrap it up right there. And
okay.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And as one last shout out, where do people go to find out about October 22nd?
Well, they can go to the website www.october22.org. They can also go to the website www.revcom.us, and they'll find an article from me all out for October 22nd. And they'll also find out an article on my trial for my protests of stop and frisk that's going to begin the day after October 22nd, October 23rd in Queens, New York.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thank you, Michael.
All right, take care, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party about the upcoming National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation on October 22nd. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Michelle Alexander about her book, The New Jim Crow. Now, this interview was done a number of years ago when Michelle's book first came out, but unfortunately, it still is extremely relevant for what's going on in the country today, in the world today, especially in relation to the criminalization and the oppression and repression of black people in this country, the slow genocide. So stay tuned.
Go down to a department store, myself some freedom. Wish I could go down to a department store, buy myself some freedom.
Welcome back. That was Otis Taylor with I'm Gonna Buy Myself Some Freedom. All right. Right now we're going to be listening to the second half of the show is going to be dedicated to listening to an interview I did with Michelle Alexander shortly after her book, The New Jim Crow, came out. And as I already said, this book is extremely important in relation to what's happening to black people in America today. And so with no more ado, let's jump into the interview. I'm really, really pleased with this segment. We're going to feature Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And I have to tell you, this is an incredibly, I know the book has been out for a little bit of time, but it's an incredible critique, an insightful and incisive critique of present-day U.S. society and the systematic oppression of black people that's at its heart. And Michelle really shows the current-day U.S. criminal justice system, through the war on drugs in particular, it functions as a new system of racial control, straight up. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You argue that the systematic mass incarceration of black people and brown people, but particularly black people over the last 30 years, has created a new racial caste system. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. Well, I believe that within a few decades after the collapse of the old Jim Crow, we as a nation have managed to recreate racial caste in America. Of course, with the election of Barack Obama, it's widely believed we finally triumphed over race. But in some major American cities, the majority of African-American men are locked behind bars or labeled felons for life. And once you're labeled a felon, you're trapped. You're trapped in a permanent second-class status in which you may be denied the right to vote, automatically excluded from juries, and legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, food stamps, public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind during the Civil Rights Movement are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. That's why I say we haven't ended racial caste in America. We've merely redesigned it by targeting African Americans primarily through the war on drugs and branding them felons, often at young ages before they even are of age to vote, by branding millions of young people of color as felons, often for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, the very crimes that are largely ignored in middle-class white communities. Branding them felons, we are recreating a caste system where these people are locked in a permanent second-class status for life.
It's very heavy. You make the argument in your book that the American penal system has emerged as a system of social control unparalleled in world history.
Yes.
And you started to speak to this being a gateway to a much larger and multifaceted system of racial stigmatization and permanent marginalization. But can you give people really a sense? I mean, I know there's the general thing of what it looks like in terms of all of its various aspects and facets, and we'll get into them a little later. But can you give people a sense of the scope of this? Because that's a pretty heavy statement, a system of social control unparalleled in world history.
Yes. Well, consider this. You know, today there are more African Americans in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. You know, there's more African Americans under correctional control today than were enslaved. You know, that's the scope and size of this. You know, I think part of the problem is that when people go to prison, they're out of sight and out of mind. So, you know, it's easy for us to be in denial about just the sheer size, scope, and scale of mass incarceration because prisons, for the most part, are out of public view. But the reality is that, you know, within a few decades, our prison population has quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing rates of incarceration even in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. And this explosion in our prison population has not been driven by crime rates. You know, the popular supposedly colorblind justification for the mass incarceration of people of color is crime rates. But as I describe in some detail in my book, crime rates do not even begin to explain the astounding and rapid increase in imprisonment in African American communities. The war on drugs is the primary cause of the prison boom, a war that has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies consistently show that people of color are no more likely than whites to use or sell illegal drugs. Now, more than 30 million people have been arrested since the drug war began, the vast majority of whom are people of color. And while many people assume that the drug war was declared in response to rising drug crime in inner-city communities, it's just not true. The war on drugs was declared officially, the current drug war was officially declared by President Ronald Reagan in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was a couple years before crack hit the streets in Los Angeles and later spread to inner-city communities across America. The drug war was declared in response to racial politics, not drug crime. It was part of the grand strategy of the Republican Party to appeal to poor and working class white voters through racially coded get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare. Republican Party strategists and pollsters found that they could be highly successful in appealing to white, poor and working class folks, particularly in the South, through using, you know, racially coded get-tough appeals on crime and welfare. In fact, H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's White House chief of staff, observed, the whole problem, this is a quote, The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Well, they did. You know, a few years after the drug war was announced and crack hit the streets, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner-city crack babies, crack mothers, crack whores. You know, the goal was to make inner-city crack abuse and violence a media sensation, bolstering public support for the drug war so that it would be possible to turn what had been a rhetorical war into a literal one. And the plan worked like a charm. For more than a decade, you know, black drug dealers and users would be regulars in newspaper stories and would saturate the evening news. Congress and state legislatures nationwide would devote billions of dollars to the drug war and pass harsh mandatory minimum sentences. Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove that they could be even tougher on crime, tougher on the dark-skinned others who had been, you know, defined in the media as the source of all our social ills. And with an incredibly short period of time, not in response to crime rates. Again, crime rates have fluctuated, you know, over the past 30 years and are today, you know, at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. They've moved independently of crime rates due to a war that has been declared not against drugs, but against communities defined by race.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Michelle Alexander, who's the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Well, let's talk about this war on drugs and how this is the engine shaping and driving forward this whole new racial caste system. Can you talk, in your book, you go into a lot of detail about the mechanics of this. Can you sort of give us some of the highlights of that, how it actually works?
Yes. Well, one of the biggest myths about the drug war is that it's focused on rooting out drug kingpins or violent offenders. But nothing could be further from the truth. Federal funding flows to those state and local law enforcement agencies that are willing to boost dramatically the volume of their drug arrests, the sheer numbers. You know, the Reagan administration adopted, you know, new rules and new programs that authorized millions of dollars in federal funding to flow to agencies, some of which had initially been reluctant to wage the drug war, feeling that it would be a distraction from more, you know, important crimes like murder, rape, and robbery. And the way in which the Reagan administration persuaded law enforcement agencies to get on board with the drug war was through bribes, through cash, cash grants that were made available to law enforcement agencies that would drastically increase just the sheer volume of drug arrests. And to make matters worse, the Reagan administration managed to change federal drug forfeiture laws so that state and local law enforcement agencies could keep for their own use 80% of the cars, cash, homes seized from drug suspects, thus granting law enforcement a direct monetary interest in the profitability of the drug market. Well, you know, the results have been entirely predictable. You know, people of color are rounded up en masse. Kids are stopped and searched on their way to school. Once they learn to drive a car, their cars are often searched in the hopes of finding drugs, sometimes dismantled. There's sweeps of, you know, public housing projects, schools for drugs. And again, they're not necessarily looking for violent offenders or drug kingpins. They're trying to boost their numbers of drug arrests in these communities. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sale. You know, most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or even selling activity. In fact, during the 1990s, the period of the most dramatic expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests was for marijuana possession. You know, a drug, you know, now widely believed to be less harmful than alcohol or tobacco and at least as prevalent in middle-class white communities as it is in communities of color. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. In fact, in some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders are African-American. So, you know, through financial incentives and the Supreme Court granting law enforcement license to stop and search just about anyone, anywhere, so long as they're able to extract consent. You know, the drug war has managed to brand millions of people felons. And, you know, once you're branded, discrimination against you is legal for the rest of your life. People who are released from prison have an extraordinarily difficult time finding jobs. They're forced to check that box on the employment application, no matter if the, you know, minor drug felony they may have committed was 20 years ago, still having to check that box on employment applications. States deny people branded felons professional licenses. Thousands of professional licenses are off limits to felons. Some states you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been branded a felon.
Let me ask you this, Michelle. First, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Michelle Alexander, who's the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She's also, as it says on your book cover, you're a civil rights advocate and litigator, and you're also at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State.
That's, yes.
You know, when you're talking about this, to me, it's really, it's just overwhelming. And again, I sat up and I was rereading your book last night, and I was just, you know, it just pounds you in the head with the, you know, when you go through this and you realize it suddenly jumps out at you. And you tell an interesting story about how this is not something that is really commonly known to a lot of people, including yourself, that you had actually been involved in fighting around civil rights and racism and all this other stuff. But, and then you tell a story about seeing an orange poster or something on a telephone pole, and it's talking about the war on drugs as a war on the people or whatever. And you just kind of dismissed it and then came to see, wow, there's really something to this. And I think it'd be interesting to talk about that a little bit, because one thing as you're getting into this, and even including the kind of branding that people go through, but the whole way that this process develops, that virtually everything that people consider to be basic rights and constitutional rights has been gutted and overruled by the Supreme Court. Decisions have been made. It's incredible when you look at what gets, and people don't know this, what gets concentrated up in the war on drugs legally. How many rights and how many things have been redefined in order to facilitate this mass incarceration of people of color?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court has eviscerated, just shredded, many of the constitutional protections that once protected people from arbitrary and discriminatory police action. Through a series of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it perfectly legal, you know, for the police to stop people on the street, question them about, you know, potential drug activity or criminal activity, frisk them. So long as, you know, the demand is phrased as a question, it's perfectly legal. So if the police say, will you put your arms up in the air and will you turn and face the wall so we can frisk you, and the person complies, that's interpreted as consent. And so there's no reason for law enforcement to have even reasonable suspicion of criminal activity as long as they, quote unquote, get consent. Now, of course, many people are not brave enough or foolish enough to resist the police when they say, you know, will you put your hands up in the air? May I search your car? People don't understand those to be questions. They understand them to be demands and comply. And often when people do try to resist and refuse consent to search, they face, you know, police brutality. So the U.S. Supreme Court really has paved the way for the roundup of millions of Americans for relatively minor drug offenses. And the Supreme Court has also made it virtually impossible to prove racial bias in the criminal justice system. People always ask me, well, you know, if the system is as biased as you say it is, why don't we hear more about it in the news? Why aren't people filing lawsuits about it? Well, the reason there are not more lawsuits challenging racial bias in the criminal justice system is that the Supreme Court has closed the doors to claims of racial bias at all stages of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. In a series of cases, beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court has said that no matter how severe the racial disparities, no matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence, if you can't provide proof that the law enforcement official was acting out of conscious racial bias, you can't even get in the courthouse door, can't even state a claim of discrimination. Now, of course, in the age of colorblindness, where everyone knows better than to say, I stopped him because he was black, I sought the death penalty because he was black, I refused to give him a good plea deal because he was black, because everyone knows better even to say such things, insisting on evidence of conscious racial bias, a smoking gun, guarantees that the routine discrimination that African Americans face in the criminal justice system will never be subject to judicial scrutiny. And in this way, the mass incarceration of African Americans has been immunized from challenge in the legal system, much in the same way that the Supreme Court once protected the institutions of slavery and Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm. Let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Now, Michelle, let's dig into this a little bit more, because you talk about this thing about the colorblindness. And even there, I mean, it's, you know, I was really struck by the fact that the things that you bring out about the actual closing down of any ability to address these kinds of things or to challenge discrimination and racial profiling and all this. And in fact, you make a point that the Supreme Court, a very little known decision or a very little known thing, is that the Supreme Court has actually sanctioned, has officially approved, said that the police can actually use race as a factor in determining what they do.
Yes. Well, I call it the dirty little secret about racial profiling, which is that the U.S. Supreme Court has actually authorized law enforcement to use race as a factor in making decisions about whom to stop and search. Now, this is particularly relevant today, you know, now that Arizona has passed the law authorizing law enforcement to demand citizenship papers from anyone, you know, it suspects might be in the country illegally. The claim that this will inevitably lead to racial profiling is absolutely right, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said, specifically in the context of immigration, but it's a decision that applies in drug law enforcement as well, that race can be used as a factor in making decisions about whom to stop and search. So many people hope that the U.S. Supreme Court would reverse that case. It's United States versus Brignone-Ponce. In that case, the court concluded that the police could take a person's Mexican appearance into account when developing reasonable suspicion that a vehicle may contain undocumented immigrants. You know, the court said, quote, "The likelihood that any person of Mexican ancestry is an alien is high enough to make Mexican appearance a relevant factor, you know, in decisions about whom to stop and search." Now, that's, you know, absurd, the idea that anyone who looks Mexican is a reasonable suspect as an illegal immigrant is outrageous. And today, you know, many law enforcement agencies claim that they don't engage in racial profiling, but they do so, they make those claims with a wink and a nod, because they know that they have been authorized by the Supreme Court to use race as a factor, and as long as race isn't the only factor, the only reason for the stop, they can get away with racial profiling.
Well, let's pursue this a little bit more, because one of the contradictions you wrestle with very, very movingly in the entire book, and it's in the title, is that the idea that this is supposedly a colorblind society. And the fact is that you talk about this, and that being raised in such a profoundly racialized and racist system of control and oppression that you lay bare in this, you really get a sense of what the hell is going on here. And then you talk about this in terms of what we've just been talking about, in terms of one of the expressions of how this contradiction plays itself out is the cops and the prosecutors being able to say, we're not dealing with race here, even though they clearly are. They say, we're just using our discretion. And you make two points in that. One is the incredible power that a prosecutor has in the courtroom process and the whole process of actually convicting someone of all this and sending them on their further into the whole system of oppression, this whole new caste system. And then the police. And actually, I had to jump up when you laid out this point about the discretion, the police using their discretion, or their idea that their discretion just told them to do this, when actually what role they, you know, discretion plays in choosing where they make raids, who they go after, neighborhoods, things like that. So could you talk a little bit about how this they deal with this colorblindness by actually granting this incredible power of discretion to the cops and the prosecutors?
Yes. Well, you know, on their face, drug laws are race neutral, you know, the laws aren't written so that they apply differently to black people or white people or Latinos. On their face, they appear race neutral, but they are enforced in a racially discriminatory manner. And they are able to be forced in a racially discriminatory manner because law enforcement has been granted virtually unbridled discretion in making decisions about who will be stopped and searched, who will be charged for what crimes. There is very little oversight or accountability for law enforcement decisions about who will be stopped, who will be searched, and the same goes for prosecutors. So prosecutors and police have this enormous discretion about whom on the street to view as a suspect, who to go after, who to stop and frisk, who to let walk by. And this enormous discretion inevitably produces racial disparities. Why? Because we all have conscious as well as unconscious biases about who the criminals are. And, you know, as I indicated earlier, these biases and stereotypes, they don't exist in our head purely by accident. They've been created by media campaigns that have been waged by politicians. You know, as I indicated, the fact that our television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug dealers during the crack epidemic isn't an accident. You know, the Reagan administration actually launched a media campaign and hired people whose job it was to publicize inner city, you know, crack users and dealers. And so it's, you know, it's no surprise that, you know, when a survey was done in 1995 asking people, close your eyes for a minute and imagine a drug criminal, you know, 95% of the respondents pictured an African American. Only 5% pictured someone of any other race. So, you know, we now have in our public consciousness an association of crime and race that is deep and profound. And the association between African Americans and drug use and drug sale is profound, even though, you know, people of color are no more likely to use or sell drugs as whites. And the Supreme Court has said as long as law enforcement can identify, you know, some reason besides race for the stop, it's okay for them to use race as one factor. And the absurdity of this logic is, you know, can be evidenced by the fact that the police almost never stop someone solely because of race. You know, a young black kid wearing baggy pants standing in front of his high school surrounded by a group of similarly dressed black friends may be stopped and searched because the police thinks, you know, he looks like a drug dealer. But clearly race is not the only reason for that conclusion. You know, gender, age, attire, and location are playing a role. The police probably would ignore an 85-year-old black man standing in the same spot surrounded by a group of elderly black women. So there will always be factors that can be cited in addition to race.
Let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. One thing I found really, one of the things that really jumped out at me is when you made this comparison about the police choosing to go into, quote, unquote, the hood, you know, and then as opposed to if you were really going to go after drugs in a sense of like, you know, a lot of drug use on college campuses, well, they're not bringing SWAT teams in and busting down the walls of dormitories or frat houses to do this kind of thing. And they actually, that discretion is exactly the point you're just talking about, this sort of, this bias that's actually factored into the whole way that they choose to do things. You know, it's really, it's incredibly powerful exposure.
Yes, that's right. Discretion is exercised not only in who will be selected for an investigation or a stop or a search, but also where law enforcement resources will be concentrated in the drug war. And the reality is that, you know, middle-class white communities would never tolerate the drug war tactics that are routine in poor communities of color. Not tolerate it. Not for a moment. Because, you know, drug warriors are not going after the violent offenders, the drug kingpins. They are stopping and searching kids en masse and shipping them off to juvie, or if they're old enough, branding them as felons and sending them to adult prisons for extremely minor drug offenses. You know, again, you know, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests during the 90s was for simple marijuana possession. This drug war was rounding up folks by the thousands for simple possession of marijuana. This would not be tolerated in upper middle class white communities or on college campuses. In fact, just this week at Reed College, I don't know if you saw the story. It was actually a story made the New York Times. And Reed College, there had been a couple of heroin overdoses. Now, Reed College is located in Portland, Oregon, and it's been notorious for open drug use on campus, but there are two heroin overdoses on the campus, and police actually sent a message to the students apologizing for, you know, their loss and warning them that, you know, they were now going to have to enforce drug laws on campus for the first time, and that, you know, undercover agents were going to be going to fraternity and sorority parties, and that was warning them, you know, stop using marijuana, basically put your drugs away, because we're going to have to start enforcing drug laws on your campus. Now imagine, you know, how often do kids in the hood get a kind letter from law enforcement expressing sorrow over, you know, any drug-related losses that, you know, their friends may have experienced, and warning them in advance that, you know, undercover agents were going to be swarming their schools or their neighborhoods. No.
Right. And we're so sorry that we've completely destroyed an entire generation of people. Don't, you know, just we'll make it up to you. You know, that's a, let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I have two questions left for you, Michelle, that I really want to try and get to, but we have about 5 minutes to do it in, so I'll ask them real quick. You started to hit on this before, and this point about the invisible punishment aspect of the whole thing and the impact of the prison label, because to me it really seems that a big part of this is exactly robbing the humanity of people of color, black people in particular.
Yes. You know, I think many people who have themselves never been branded felons or don't have family members who have been just have no idea of all of the forms of legal discrimination that felons face and the extraordinary hurdles that exist to just making it, just surviving once you've been branded a felon. You know, as I mentioned before, you know, employment discrimination is legal against you for the rest of your life. But public housing is also off limits. You know, during the Jim Crow era, that was the era of racially restrictive covenants. But today, housing discrimination against people branded felons is perfectly legal in the private and public housing markets. Public housing is off limits to you for a minimum of 5 years when you're released from prison. And in fact, your relatives risk eviction if they live in public housing and allow you to come stay with them when you're released from prison. So here you are, no job, nowhere to go. Many homeless shelters even screen for criminal convictions. Food stamps are off limits to you for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. Pregnant women, people with HIV or AIDS, ineligible for food stamps for the rest of your life if you've been convicted of a drug felony. What do we expect these folks to do? Well, you know, the great irony is that what we expect of them is to pay often thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. Some states now actually require released prisoners to pay back the cost of their incarceration. And up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. You know, even if you're one of the lucky few who managed to get a job following release from prison, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished to pay back all these fees, fine, court costs, accumulated back child support. You know, what do we expect these folks to do? What does the system seem designed to do? Well, it seems designed to return folks right back to prison, which is what, in fact, happens about 70% of the time. About 70% of released prisoners return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return do so in a matter of months, because the challenges associated with just mere survival, making it in the legal economy and the mainstream society, are so extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So when I say we have a caste system going on today, I mean that this isn't just a matter of people lacking the proper motivation, will, or drive to succeed. No, quite to the contrary. There is a system of rules, laws, and policies in place that serve to lock people in a second-class status for life by law.
And that's one of the things that you even begin your book with, talking about, you know, really at the root of the U.S.-style democracy, this whole creation of a pariah class was really essential to the flourishing of that, to that style of democracy, that system of democracy they have here, to allowing that to flourish. It required a pariah class that consisted of black people, slaves, of Native Americans, of women to a certain extent. And it really did, you know, in order for them to deal with this contradiction of supposedly having a colorblind society, even back then where everybody was equal, they just created a pariah class that contained all the people that weren't equal or weren't even human. And that today still seems to be very much at the core of how the society is running.
Absolutely. Every caste system is firmly rooted in the notion that some people lack basic humanity. Many people ask me, well, today most people aren't openly bigoted. Most people aren't openly racist, including police officers. Most of them aren't, don't think of themselves as racist, don't want to be racist. How could something akin to a racial caste system exist when most people don't even want to be racist or thought of in that way? And Martin Luther King Jr. warned of precisely this kind of thinking more than 45 years ago. You know, he told audiences again and again before his death that, you know, racial caste systems are rooted in indifference, racial indifference, not in bigotry or, you know, overt hostility. You know, it's indifference to the suffering and the plight of people of other races that allows caste systems to emerge and to thrive. He would often point out, you know, even the justices who decided the infamous Dred Scott case, the case that, you know, ruled that the black man has no rights which the white man is bound to respect. He argued those men weren't evil men. By and large, they were decent and, you know, honorable men trying to do right, but they were suffering from a profound spiritual and intellectual blindness. They knew not what they did. And today, you know, I think the same can be said. Just as in the Jim Crow era, many segregationists, many people who voted for segregation were actually kind, very kind to their black shoe shiners, their black maids, genuinely wished them well, weren't hostile towards them, but nonetheless voted for segregation. Today, many people of goodwill and bad.
We have to wrap it up, Michelle. As much as I really don't want to do this, we have to. And I would just make one comment off of that, though. I have heard it rumored that Hitler did like his dog. Okay, so let's not make any excuses for these fools out there. Michelle, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right.
And your book is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. It's from the New Press, a fascinating book, a really important book for anybody who gives a damn about what's going on in the world. We'll talk to you again soon, Michelle.
Take care.
Bye now. All right, that brings us to the end of another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix and Michelle Alexander. And I want to thank my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with Incarceration from Sunrise Above. Check this out.
Live when they sentence you to prison, feeling cold and empty gutted like from an incision. Some fall back on religion, last refuge of a free faller, and you can't call her. So holler if you hear me through the cell walls, like being trapped in hell. I'm trying to tell y'all, when you lock men in cages, they can turn to animals, contagious. Dog eat dog, rabid cannibals. Start off from the bullpen where you'll spend many hours sleeping on the concrete floor and getting any shower. Stomach growling from the phony two-tone baloney that they feed you, leave you lonely in a room full of thousands. Pounding on the block with your head, wishing you dead instead of buried alive inside of a 9x10. Wishing you were kissing your children or with your girl instead of dreaming of what life's like back in the world. Inside these cement caves lives modern day slaves, working for corporations that pay a dollar a day. It takes cash to make it, so it goes to where the money's all. Build more prisons, I give them another 20 bars.